Welcome to D3, the Digital 3 podcast. A podcast about the frontier technologies that are fundamentally reshaping the economy and society. My name is Chris Berg, and I'm the director of Digital 3 at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. Digital 3 brings leading researchers, students, and the public, private, and non-profit sectors together to build the next economy. In today's episode, I'm delighted and excited to welcome Dr. Peter Rohde, Senior Quantum Researcher at BTQ, a global quantum technology company. Peter is also an honorary senior lecturer at Macquarie University. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Peter, so I'd like to start with a level-setting question. Can you, for people who are not experts in this space, can you give us a simple overview of how quantum computing differs from classical computing, the computer that we're literally using right now, the computers that we have in our phones and so forth?
Right. So the way to think about it is any type of computer ultimately is built in a physical way. It's built on some kind of physical system. And all the computers that we've had up until recently have all been based on classical physics. The way digital circuits work, it's all just zeros and ones. Those are classical concepts built on classical physics. Quantum physics introduces new physical rules, new things that are possible, like superpositions, where, for example, an electron energy level of an atom can be in multiple states in superposition at the same time that doesn't have a classical analogy. So quantum computing is about building computers that exploit these additional degrees of freedom in physics that don't exist in classical physics. And the consequence of that is that in certain circumstances, you're able to exploit that to get algorithmic advantage. They sometimes talk about quantum advantage or quantum supremacy as being the era in which quantum computers can do things that significantly outperform classical computers. So it's really about what the underlying physical assumptions of the system are and how they can be exploited in the best possible way. And quantum computers, well, because they're built on quantum physics, they also present very, very significant engineering problems. Building transistors, we've done for a very long time. Quantum systems where you're manipulating individual particles, photons, electrons, atoms, that's an enormous engineering challenge, which is why we don't have useful quantum computers yet.
So, I mean, you've raised the challenge or the goal, I should say, of quantum supremacy. Obviously, we seem to be going through, maybe it's a hype cycle at the moment in the quantum computing industry. Maybe it's just a wave of technology, a summer of innovation. Where are we in the evolution of this technology?
So there are different ways to answer that. From a theoretical perspective, we've known for a very long time what's needed to build a large-scale quantum computer. However, it turns out, as I mentioned, that because these engineering requirements are so daunting, we're not really close to having a large-scale quantum computer. Where we are at the moment is what they sometimes call the NISQ era, which is near-term intermediate-scale quantum computers. And this refers to small-scale quantum computers that don't have error correction. And error correction is a very important notion in quantum computing because errors propagate through quantum systems. And if you don't error correct them, then it puts a fundamental limit on how big you can make the quantum computer. So at the moment, we're in that sort of in-between zone where we can build qubits and simple circuits, but it's not even possible in principle to scale them up because we don't have the error correction mechanisms.
I want to get to the business and social science aspects of that, but just driving a little bit further into that, that need for the error correction, that's basically, if I understand it correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that's basically because quantum computers or quantum calculations are probabilistic in a way that classical computers are deterministic. So you need to keep checking them. Is that
well, a fair description? Well, it's more than probabilistic. You can have classical probabilistic computers too. For example, if you consider any sort of randomized algorithm like a Monte Carlo simulation, that's a probabilistic approach, but it's a classical probabilistic approach. The concepts that quantum computers take advantage of is more than just probabilities. It's this notion of superposition. A probability means you're in one of a number of distinct states, exactly one of them, but they follow a probability distribution. The notion of a superposition in quantum physics is distinct from that because the state is actually all of those things simultaneously with those different weights. So that there's a fundamental difference between probabilistic computing and quantum computing. However, there is, coming back to what you said about needing to go back and check for errors all the time, that's exactly what you need to do, because the errors do propagate, and if you allow them to propagate too much, it destroys your computation. So when you build a quantum computer, you have a logical operation that you want to implement, some set of gates, implementing an algorithm, and then over the top of that, you build all these error-correcting codes that every single time step gets those errors back within some reasonable limits so that it doesn't just exponentially blow out. And that's the hard part, because that error correction requires constant interaction. You have to be reading parts of the system, decoding it, figuring out what error correction you need to apply, come back in, adjust the circuit, move on to the next step. That's the hard part.
I'm interested in your perspective about where we are on that, as I said, that hype cycle. So where are we in the patterns of investment around quantum computing as well?
Yeah, I'd say we're probably at hype to the max at the moment, as is often the case in any boom-bust cycle. But when it comes to quantum technology, there's a tendency for it to be somewhat more hyped than what you would normally expect in a boom-bust.
Look, I'm used to the crypto industry, so nothing is more hyped.
Sure. When it comes to the various coins and blockchains, you're absolutely right. It's a similar kind of thing. And perhaps the reason that we're so susceptible to this hype in the quantum sector is because it's so easy to misunderstand important nuances. Obviously, not everybody can be an expert in quantum computing. And what that means is that through no fault of oneself, it's very easy to misrepresent how a quantum computer works or what the nuances are, and get completely the wrong idea. So to clarify some wrong ideas, quantum computing does not mean that every single possible algorithm is going to get a huge speed up. It's actually a fairly restricted class of algorithms where you can get advantage. And amongst those, it isn't clear to us yet even what all of the applications are. It's quite possible that the real killer app for quantum computing in the future is one that we don't even know of yet. So it's not correct that they speed up everything. They speed up a certain class of problems. And for the class of problems that it does speed up, it's also not the case that a quantum computer just, boom, spontaneously solves it. There's still significant execution time.
So can you give me an example of something that, your instinct about what a quantum computer would be good at and what a classical computer will always or into the foreseeable future outperform a quantum machine?
Right. So some of the things that quantum computers have been shown to provide advantage for, theoretically, even though it hasn't been physically realized yet, include certain number theoretic problems. So integer factorization is one of the really important ones. That's important because it underscores that how the RSA public key encryption system works. It's based on integer factorization. If you can factorize large integers, you can crack a public key to get the private key from it. So that's one where we know that quantum computers can do this efficiently, and classical computers, to the best of our understanding, can't. And then there are various other applications as well. There are all sorts of simulation applications. If you're simulating a quantum system, for example, something with molecular interactions, for example, that's an inherently quantum system. You try and map that across to a classical algorithm, and it takes forever.
So it's very good at simulating quantum.
Yeah, because there's a direct mapping from the levels inside the quantum system you're simulating to the different levels in the superposition states of the quantum computer representing it. Things where you would not expect to get any advantage from quantum computing would be probably everything that you're doing on your laptop right now.
Recording a podcast.
Yeah, I mean, people often say, right.
Sally will be very disappointed to hear that.
Gamers come up to me and say, am I going to get like brilliant ray traced graphics all of a sudden, out of this world? Graphics performance, no. They're not the sorts of algorithms that lend themselves to any kind of quantum advantage, at least as far as we know. So what that probably means is that you'll never, ever have a quantum computer in your pocket. Not even if it becomes technologically possible to miniaturize it and make it practical to do so. It'd probably be dumb to do it because there's nothing you do on your phone or your laptop that would actually take advantage of it.
Mm.
So the way we would use this technology would be in ways that we tend not to see, over on the cloud side, in the back end somewhere. Someone's doing some important optimization in the background, and that comes across in our client-side interfaces, but that's probably the way it would be used in sort of data centers, backbones, that kind of thing.
So it's a sort of large-scale infrastructure technology in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, and highly expensive. So it's going to, no matter how far the technology comes, quantum computing is always going to be much more expensive than classical computing.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, that sort of leads me onto one of my, the other things that's interesting to me. So I guess one of the implications of that at the moment is that a lot of the funding comes from government, or at least certainly, and certainly the early users would be government. Do you foresee substantial private sector use of that in the medium to near term?
I mean, these things are very, very hard to predict, but it certainly isn't the case that the only applications are ones that are of governmental or security or intelligence interest. Like, code breaking is the one that got a lot of balls rolling early on. But if you think of things like I mentioned before, quantum simulation, well, that has widespread applications. Think of simulating drugs, how they interact inside the body. These days, we do it all with mass trials to figure out what's going on. Suppose you could just directly simulate it and bypass all that. You know, that would be an absolute boon in the private sector. Mm. There are also quantum computers can speed up, at least to some extent, and depending upon the nature of them, different types of optimization problems. And like optimization problems show up all over the place.
Like supply chain management.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, and those sorts of problems are often, in computer science, they call them NP-complete problems. They're a type of problem that just become exponentially hard on classical computers. And it's not the case that quantum computers can efficiently solve NP-complete problems, but they can certainly give you some speed up compared to what the classical computer can do.
I guess the question that I have is, so even if the, I'll step back. It strikes me that we could have made the same criticisms of classical computing 50 or 60 years ago as well. Extremely capital intensive, very narrow set of use cases, almost entirely focused in the defense industry, certainly rolling back maybe 80 years and so forth. Is there an environment that you could see? And that contributes towards the centralization of the industry. There's only a couple of computers that are owned by very big organizations or governments. But now we're in this world where, as you say, we've all got phones in our pockets, we've all got computers on our desks. Mm-hmm. Is that a potential path? Because that contributes towards the decentralization, but it also contributes towards what I'd call the political economy of quantum. We're worried about this in a geopolitical sense rather than in a sort of small-scale industry.
Right. So when it comes to those considerations, these are ones that are already at the forefront of government's minds at the moment. Mm. Even though it's going to be some time before we have large-scale useful quantum computers, governments are already very concerned about what would happen if in the future they get into the wrong hands. And already many countries, including our own, consider various quantum technologies as being dual-use ones that are subject to all sorts of export restrictions, and there are certain places where you're not allowed to be collaborating or sharing results with them. All of that's already emerging preemptively. So the geopolitical stuff, those are really important considerations. And what it does mean is it's highly likely that what you said is going to be the case, that there'll be a relatively small number of quantum computers. There'll be lots of top-down control in who's allowed to have them. They'll be very protective about them, governments. And that will inevitably result in some amount of centralization, all sorts of restrictions on who can access them. It's not likely to be as free as classical computing is, where you can just walk into a corner shop and buy a piece of electronics and walk out.
Yeah, I mean, but that was true originally for classical computers as well.
It did change over time, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, so sort of dwelling on that a little bit. So I know Australia has a national quantum strategy. Mm-hmm. Quantum cryptography, particularly, is listed as one of the products on Australia's defense and strategic goods list. There are export controls. Have those? You're a practitioner. You are building quantum products. You are working in the space in the private sector right now. Do those policies materially affect the development of the technology from the ground?
That's hard to say.
Is it hard to get quantum researchers?
It's not so hard to get quantum researchers here in Australia, I think. We're very welcoming of intellectual capital. if you go the other way around and start exporting it, that's where it becomes maybe a little bit more of a consideration. I don't think anybody's concerned about importing things. It's more exporting it back into the wrong hands, which is what governments are concerned about.
Mm. But it must shape the sort of geopolitics of it as well.
Certainly.
So we're concentrating quantum research and capability in certain countries. Those countries are going to have particular regulatory or policy perspectives on the development of the technology, and it's going to push it in different directions, right?
It certainly will. And it's very hard to predict how that could play out. Often it's the case that in a situation like this, that governments come in and they're thinking, how do we regulate the future threats associated with this technology? Before really much is known about what that technology might look about, it ends up being in a very knee-jerk kind of response whereby the regulatory frameworks may or may not be fit for purpose. They may or may not accurately reflect what the proper considerations in the future will be, but they know they have to do something, so they just reflexively smack down some regulations and some controls and say, right, we've done the best thing for the country. So it does get politicized. It's hard to know what the right way to draw these boundaries on regulations and restrictions is. But obviously, just like with classical technology too, you over-restrict something, you hamper its development. But given that most of this technology is in developed countries anyway, and most of those Western countries, which are generally on friendly terms, it's not so much of an obstacle.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, I mean, it strikes me that over the last decade at least, the whole technology sector has experienced this tech clash.
Mm.
We've obviously seen that in blockchain space. We're increasingly seeing it in the AI space with the Biden administration's executive order into AI, which is huge, reaching policy to control AI models at the very foundation.
Yeah.
Outside the national security space, are we seeing much concern about quantum technology?
Yeah, there is. Probably the one of those that gets the biggest attention is going back to what I discussed earlier, the cryptographic implications. Because the public key cryptography we use today, it's generally either RSA, which is based on number theory, or elliptic curve cryptography, which is based on discrete logarithm problems. Those are vulnerable to future quantum attacks. And although it will be perhaps a decade or two, something of that order, until that threat materializes, it's still necessary to be very mindful of it today because of what they widely call harvest now, crack later principles. obviously, you know, if you consider what the signals intelligence agencies around the world are doing, they have huge data centers. They're just scooping up stuff from the internet and saving it. And it's, although they're not going to confirm it, you just assume that this is what they're going to do. They're going to be inevitably saving things that might be high value information that they can't crack now, with the hope that in 10 or 20 years' time, they'll be able to come back to it. So information that's secured using present-day public key cryptography that may be vulnerable to quantum computing in the future, it is already necessary to think, is that information going to have forward value at the time when that threat materializes?
Hmm.
And there'll be lots of cases where it doesn't. If you consider a bank transaction using short-term session keys, but when you finish the transaction, it doesn't matter if you can break the keys, the transaction's done and it's not recognized anymore with those keys. But there are other scenarios where you might have keys that are protecting information with long-term value. If it's something that's intelligence-related or national security-related or intellectual property, company secrets, they can have enormous long-term value.
I mean, I think this is a good opportunity then to ask you to tell us a little bit about what you do at BTQ and what the mission of BTQ is.
Yeah, right. So previously in academia, I was always very much focused on quantum computing as my interest. This is now a switch in a slightly different direction, which is post-quantum cryptography. So having said what I just said about the threats that quantum computing presents to public key cryptography, that doesn't mean it's the end of the world. There is an answer. It is, certainly is. Otherwise, it would be a big problem. And we resort back to meeting in dark alleys to speak to people. but we don't need to, thankfully, because NIST, the standardization institute in the United States, they're currently in the process of standardizing what we call post-quantum cryptography, which is a next generation of public key crypto systems that are not vulnerable to quantum attacks. So that's being standardized at the moment. And if you read through some of the tech news, you'll notice inevitably that some companies are already announcing transitions to post-quantum cryptography. Like Signal, the encrypted messaging app, they've recently announced they're transitioning to post-quantum cryptography.
So is post-quantum cryptography that advanced that it's sort of production-ready?
Well, this is where it becomes delicate, and you need to be very careful of the nuances. So when we talk about these new generation cryptographic protocols being robust against quantum computing, in cryptography, nothing is ever really proven.
Mm.
It's always based on what are perceived to be very strong assumptions, usually assumptions based on computational complexity theory. In any case, we don't have any proof whatsoever that these new generation cryptographic techniques are robust against quantum computing. Rather, the mathematical problems that they've been that they are based on have been studied for some significant time, and to the best of our understanding, there's no reason to believe quantum computers would be able to attack them.
So let's just dig into that a bit. So again, correct me if I'm wrong, but when we say that a classical cryptographic standard is robust against an attack, that means if we were to do a random search through all the possibilities, it would take X million years to find a result. And we can assume that, but in fact, in practice, you might find a result in the first 2 minutes because it's a random search through the space. When we're saying that something is robust to quantum computing or quantum post-quantum cryptography, that's basically what we're saying there
so,
as well.
Yeah, so to qualify that, so if you think of the integer factorization problem upon which RSA cryptography is based, it's not so much that, you know, by chance you could find the right key or by brute forcing it. It's more that integer factorization has structure in it. It's not an unstructured problem. So if you have a completely unstructured problem, if I give you an unordered database with trillions of entries, then the best you can do is just start systematically going through all of them. And that's effectively a proof that you can't crack it because you know that it's, you know, 1/2 to the n, where n is large, probability of being able to find the right element, you know, by chance or something. If we can argue that something is only vulnerable to a brute force attack, that's effectively a proof that it's a strong crypto system.
Yeah.
The problem is that effectively no cryptographic algorithms can you argue that the only way to attack it is with brute force. There are hidden structures underneath the mathematical problems that can be exploited to avoid having to do that.
Mm. So how are governments responding to this particular challenge of post-quantum cryptography? Is this entirely coming out of the private sector, or is this a major conversation in the departments of defenses around the world?
Right. So the way it's the way it's being approached at the moment is that it's for quite some time now. People have been suggesting various post-quantum cryptographic primitives. NIST decided they want to standardize these. So they run a competition. They say, right, anybody who would like to submit a candidate algorithm, we'll put it to the test and run it through our various, KPI checks to make sure it satisfies all the criteria, and then we'll make a decision about standardizing it. So it's generally a very open process, and some of those submissions come from academic researchers. Some of those submissions are coming from private sector companies. But at the end of it, these will be open standards, right? That much like the cryptographic protocols we use at the moment are open standards, standardized. However, that's not the end of the story, because just because something is standardized doesn't actually prove that it is actually robust. The ultimate test is the test of time. Once they've been subject to hammer attacks and hackers for a decade or two, and nobody's managed to empty out all the bank accounts, that's really when you have confidence that nobody can break it, right?
Well, that's genuinely very terrifying, of course.
It is, right? But this is how we know that our current crypto systems are robust, because no one's been able to steal all my bank account money.
Look, and there have been cryptographic standards that have been proven to not work.
Oh, sure. Well. I mean, that's happened too. There was actually an interesting case in the standardization of these post-quantum cryptographic protocols by NIST at the moment. One of the candidates, someone found that using a side channel attack, they were able to crack it on a laptop.
So a side channel attack?
A side channel attack is one where you're not attacking the actual algorithm itself, but you're attacking incorrect ways of implementing it. So the way that this one worked, it was a timing attack. What they found was that the execution time of the algorithm was a function of what the key is. So just by measuring timing signatures, you're able to infer information about the key. So that's a side channel attacker. They weren't attacking the underlying mathematical properties, but rather an implementation issue, which was that there are correlations that leak information. Mm-hmm. And that's always a type of attack that it's up to your imagination how the threats could materialize. And if there's no way of seeing it just by reading through how the algorithm works.
And so many privacy and security challenges are really based on that leakage of information. You can design something theoretically pure, when in practice it gets used in the real world.
Exactly. And the same thing applies, incidentally, to quantum cryptography, because another way, another avenue apart from post-quantum cryptography is quantum cryptography, where you're using quantum systems for cryptography. So
to create the cryptographic.
The actual cryptographic code itself uses quantum information.
Mm-hmm.
There you actually can prove that certain protocols have what they call information theoretic security. You can actually prove that what this protocol called quantum key distribution, you can prove that if implemented as written on the piece of paper, that it is physically impossible to crack it. And, of course, that excites people. And lots of companies are now building these products. This is technology that you can buy today. The trouble is that it's very vulnerable to side channel attacks, because how easy is it to have an implementation difference between what you build and what's written on the piece of paper, when what we're dealing with on paper is the manipulation of single atomic or photonic particles? You know, it's very easy to go wrong. Much easier to go wrong than it is with digital information. So although quantum key distribution is more secure in a theoretical sense, when you get around to building it, there are more avenues for side channel attacks in general.
And I guess that's sort of what you were talking about at the start of the podcast, where we need to have just much better fault-tolerant systems in that.
Yeah, so fault tolerance, that's...
error checking.
Yeah, so I mean it's a related consideration, but here it's not so much information leakage isn't so much about error correction. It's more about there are correlations between quantum system and some external classical system. Whatever it is, timing, classical signals, whatever the case may be. Error correction is more. Within the quantum system itself, how do we keep that quantum system being in the state that it should be in? Whereas information leakage is a slightly different concept, which is correlations between the quantum system and the external environment.
Okay. So, I mean, just thinking forward, what are the – so you've mentioned a couple of use cases, but what are the use cases for quantum computing outside the cryptographic space that you're most excited by?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, probably the ones that are going to get the most real-world attention outside of cryptography are the ones I mentioned on simulating quantum systems, because that has lots of applications. If you consider something like materials engineering, I mentioned medicine, but consider materials engineering, where the properties of a material come down to the atomic structure of the way those materials are composed.
Finally, we could get the room temperature superconductor that I was very excited by a couple of months ago.
See, I don't know much about superconductors, but perhaps I don't know. I actually don't know much about how superconducting physics works. But sure, if you can efficiently simulate a very complex quantum system, that gives you enormous shortcuts in design and testing. So apart from materials engineering, anything where you're simulating something where the outcome is determined ultimately by quantum mechanical phenomena. As soon as you try to classically simulate any kind of quantum mechanical phenomena, you have this tendency for things just to blow out exponentially. So if you can bypass that, then there's your advantage. And as I said, like, it's probably not even possible to foresee what all the most exciting applications are going to be.
Yeah. So look, a final question, Peter. What should we be looking for in the development of quantum computing over the next, what, 6 to 12 months? Or maybe rephrase, what will you be watching in this industry?
Right, what are the things that are exciting me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so the way that the progression has been happening recently is it's just been one announcement after another and one demonstration of a platform after another, where it's all in this NISQ kind of era that I mentioned, where it's near-term, small-scale, not even in principle scalable to large-scale computations because it's not error-corrected. Everything so far has basically been in that category. And whenever you read anything about a result where experimentalists have shown, you know, huge computational advantage from a quantum computer, just remember,
if they don't make an error.
Yeah, well, it's actually, it's not that they haven't done a hard problem. It's just some contrived problem that doesn't have any real-world use. So what will be really exciting is when someone comes out and says, we've built some quantum bits that are properly fault-tolerant and error-corrected. Once we get that, that's when you think, right, this is going to start scaling up. When we hit that transition from just non-error protected to error protected, whether that happens in 12 months, well, who knows? But that's that would be really the turning point in the whole industry.
That's when all bets are off.
Yes,
fantastic. Thank you so much, Peter Rohde, for joining us on the D3 podcast.
The D3 podcast is produced by Sally Piper and is a product of Digital 3 at RMIT University. I'm Chris Berg, and you'll hear from us again soon.